Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. And we are going to turn our attention now to a hidden away gem in the Wisconsin countryside that, while it might not be known to everyone in Wisconsin, it was known to large numbers of Hollywood and Broadway's biggest stars in the early part of the 20th century. I'm talking about Ten Chimneys, which was the summer home of actors Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine. And joining us by phone today is Sean Malone. He is the president of the Ten Chimneys Foundation, and he is going to share with us what can be seen at Ten Chimneys and who all enjoyed it over the years. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's just funny because, you know, Ten Chimneys is located in Genesee Depot, Wisconsin, which is not exactly a booming metropolis. And yet so many of these well-known stars of stage and screen, and we will talk about some of those individuals a little later, kind of hoped to get an invitation to spend all or part of their summers there with Lynn Fontaine and Alfred Lunt. It was Alfred really that had the connection to Genesee Depot. How did it figure into his early life?
Well, Alfred Lunt, sort of going back to who Lynn and Alfred were, you know, in their day, they were the king and queen of American theater during the golden age of theater. They decided to only do stage, and so their names now are far less known than most of their lesser-known friends at the time who would come out to see them. But they were, you know, absolutely the god and goddess of the American stage, and all theater historians agree with that conclusion. Alfred was a Milwaukee boy, and so even though he was the head of Broadway, his roots were always here in Milwaukee. And his father was a lumber baron and passed away when he was 2 years old, and he had lived in a few different places. And by the time he turned 21, he came into a $30,000 trust fund inheritance from his father. His mother, Hattie, had inherited somewhere around $750,000.
And this was in what year?
This would have been 1895.
So that's a whole lot of money today.
It was
definitely a lot of money then.
And Hattie was an impressive lady and managed to not just burn through all of that money in the 19 years before Alfred turned 21, but actually had gone pretty deep into debt. Hattie, Alfred's mother, was famous for saying, "I can do without the necessities of life, but I cannot live without the luxuries." And so Alfred, when he turned 21, he got this money. He used the money to pay off his mother's debts and purchased 3 acres in Genesee Depot, where he and his mother and his half-siblings had picnicked. And he had these wonderful experiences and memories of being in Genesee Depot. And so he bought this property and helped design and had built the first portion of what is now the main house as a place for his family to live. And then, having done his familial duty, he went off to Broadway to really make a name for himself.
And so when did Lynn Fontaine enter the picture?
So not too much later after that, maybe 8-9 years later. In 1919, Lynn and Alfred met. So at this point, the house had been built. It was, to about 5 years after the house had been built. And the family was living here, and Alfred met Lynn Fontaine, who at this time, both of them were undiscovered. They were both, you know, playing mid-level parts, but on Broadway. And they fell in love. It was, by all accounts, love at first sight, even though the fuller account says that Lynn saw Alfred from behind the first time. And so they became a couple. They, when they got married, they decided that they wanted an opportunity to retreat. They knew that they needed a place to rejuvenate every year. And as they got bigger and bigger, they put it into their contract that they would never act in the summer, so that they would have this chance to retreat. And the place they wanted to retreat was this home that Alfred had already started building.
And they also dictated that they would only work together, too.
They did, yeah. This was in the mid-20s, and at this point, the Lunts were the biggest stars on Broadway, and they were each making about $900 a week, which is more than a lot of professional actors make today. And this is in the mid-20s. And so they were hugely paid, and they signed on with a brand new theater company that was doing avant-garde work and new work, you know, by people like Ibsen and Shaw. But at the time, these were really forward-thinking plays. And the Lunts gave up huge amounts of money to come sign on with the Theater Guild. The Theater Guild had said, well, you know, the most we can afford is $600. And the Lunts said, well, this is the kind of work we want to be doing. Okay, we'll do it for $600 each. And the head of the Theater Guild said, oh, dear God, I didn't mean each. And so the Lunts said, huh, okay, well, we said some things are more important than money, and I guess we believe it. But because they were taking such enormous pay cuts, they could write the rest of their contract. And as you said, one of the caveats was that they wouldn't act separately. You couldn't have Lynn starring in one play and Alfred starring in another play, even though commercially that's the smartest thing to do. Because the Lunts had some ideas about what they wanted to do for American acting. And if I can step back for a second, the Lunts are credited with transforming acting in America. And they transformed it so completely that it's almost hard to get your hands around what they did. Because they were the ones who brought, who made acting in this country heightened realism, you know, natural or, you know, slightly heightened naturalism up on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just what we think of as acting now. That's just how you would define the verb. But that's not what it was at the time. When the Lunts started, acting was oratory. Acting was declamation. You would step forward and say your speech with some pose, and then you step back, and somebody else would step forward and say their pose.
It was very static.
Absolutely, and it was pictures. It was picturesque. It was not even meant to be realism. And so the Lunts had these ideas of what they wanted to do, and I won't go into those too deeply, but they knew they had to do them together. They knew to be able to transform American acting, they had to do it as a team. They couldn't just do it one at a time, hoping other people would come along. And so they wrote that into their contract, and then the other thing they wrote into their contract was that they would never work in the summer. And they then spent the next 15 years creating the perfect retreat, room by room, art piece by art piece, vista by vista. And when they were done, somewhere in the late 30s, early 40s, they were done. And like a stage set, they didn't change anything. And so one of the things that's remarkable about Ten Chimneys when you come through today is that it looks just like it did when the Lunts were bringing through everyone who was anyone in American theater.
We're talking with Sean Malone. He is president of Ten Chimneys Foundation. Ten Chimneys was the summer retreat of Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. You can join in the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or leave a comment or a photo maybe from a visit to Ten Chimneys on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Have you visited Ten Chimneys? What stayed with you from your experience there? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. For me, one of the things that really stood out in visiting Ten Chimneys was that you really see Alfred and Lynn as real people, not just stars. Of course, they had household help, but Alfred gardened, he raised chickens and pigs, he cooked dinner every evening.
Oh, he loved it. That was one of his favorite things to do. When he finally had a 3-week vacation for outside of Ten Chimneys for the first time in his life, Lynn and Alfred were in Paris, and it was 1958, so he was in his late 60s. And his vacation was taking an intensive 3-week course at the Cordon Bleu.
Not exactly relaxing, probably,
right.
But
well,
fun.
But Lynn said he passed with flying saucepans. but he did. I mean, they really believed in great meals, both for the food, and he loved cooking. But he also loved what they did. I mean, what a great meal around a table did. And when you look at Ten Chimneys, it really reflects what was important to the Lunts. That dining room table comfortably fits 10 if you put all of the leaves in it. They liked it much better at 8. there are only three guest bedrooms, and if you came to stay at Ten Chimneys, you stayed in a guest bedroom. You didn't stay at one of the outbuildings.
Mm-hmm.
This was not Hearst Castle. It was not about big opulent parties. You know, they measured a visit in weeks or months, not days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was about.
And also, my understanding is that guests, often coming off of a long stretch of performing on Broadway or a grueling filming schedule in Hollywood, that guests would come there and often just kind of collapse. And there were no expectations of the guests. They could wake up when they wanted. They could have a meal when they wanted. They could go swimming when they wanted. It really was all about relaxing and rejuvenating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, the people who were there were extraordinary. You know, Noel Coward would come anytime he was in America. He would make a visit to Ten Chimneys, and he was a lifelong friend of the Lunts. Helen Hayes, the wonderful actress Helen Hayes, would come almost every summer and usually for a month or more. And Laurence Olivier would come all the time, sometimes early on with Vivian Leigh, later on with Joan Plowright, but it was always Larry. And, you know, Alexander Wolcott and Montgomery Clift and Kate Hepburn and Carol Channing and writers like Edna Ferber and really John Gielgud, everyone who was anyone in theater or the arts, wanted to come to Ten Chimneys. And again, it was not just to be seen. There was nothing artificial about it. As you said, there were no expectations whatsoever except to be there, except to rejuvenate in whatever that meant to the visitor, and to be there with the Lunts, and to, you know, swim in the pool, and to have fun, and to play the Noel Coward piano, and to really embrace this sense of rejuvenation, and to really engage with other people on a real level. And I think that's hard for everyone, but it's particularly hard if you're a star, you know, where there's these expectations. If you're at a dinner, you're working the dinner. You're schmoozing the dinner. You may be very charming and sincere when you do it, but that's different than being there with friends.
Mm-hmm. And Alfred's seat was actually at the end of the table where he could be most easily accessible in the kitchen, not in kind of the grand host of the house seat.
Right. Yes. He was up and down a lot. Well, he needed to make sure it was that the lamb was right.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with Sean Malone. He is president of Ten Chimneys Foundation. And I know there are people that want to join in the conversation, but we will have to wait for that after the news. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. I hope you'll stay tuned. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and we're talking with Sean Malone. He is president of Ten Chimneys Foundation. And Sean, we have several people waiting to talk with you, so let's go right to the phone. We have Jerry in Brookfield first. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you so much for this wonderful program. I was at Ford's Theater, and I saw Lynn Redgrave do Shakespeare for my father. And it was her autobiography. And she talked a lot about Ten Chimneys in that autobiography because her father, Michael, sent her and her sister, Vanessa, there for the war. Sean, mm-hmm. Can you talk about that at all? Or?
Sure, absolutely. And thanks for the question. Lynn is just an extraordinary person and came out and did a big, inaugurated a big national program that we do here. So I feel fortunate to have known Lynn, and she's just a wonderful person. Lynn Redgrave was actually named for Lynn Fontanne.
Hmm.
The story was actually that when Michael Redgrave and his wife Rachel, when the war broke out, the Lunts called them because they were good friends and said, "Do you want to send Corin and Vanessa to stay with us here at Ten Chimneys during the war? We don't know if you're leaving London. We hope you are, but if you're not leaving London, send the kids to stay with us." Now, as it happened, they were going to leave London because Rachel was pregnant with a new baby. And so they didn't end up having to send any of the children to stay at Ten Chimneys, but they were so moved by both the generosity of the Lunts and the quickness of the generosity, that as soon as it was clear that London was no place for children, the Lunts had reached out, that they decided to name their new baby Lynn.
Hmm. That's a great connection. And let's go now to Lois in Eau Claire. Hi, Lois.
Yes. I just wanted to mention that I'm now in my late 70s, and my husband and I grew up in Waukesha, and his uncle, Ben Perkins, was the caretaker for the Lunts and Ken Chimneys through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And so when we were married, of course, we'd always go out there for meals with Ben on Sundays. And a lot of times Jules would be over. And when our children were born and we'd go back to the area, the children went with us, of course. And we'd sit around Sunday dinner, and Jules would join us. And we heard some wonderful stories.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Ken Chimneys. And my understanding from Ben was that it was actually almost a small farm at one point.
A large one at one point. They had 200 acres at one point.
Right. So, yes, heard some wonderful stories. So,
if you are ever in the mood to share those stories, please email them to me. I'd love to hear that kind of first-hand or at least second-hand recollection. The Lunts loved Ben Perkins. He was their caretaker for, you know, as you said, decades. And also would drive for the Lunts when they were in town, and really cared for what was a very large estate that the Lunts were only there 3 months a year until they retired. When the Lunts retired from the stage in 1960, they moved to Ten Chimneys full time because Ten Chimneys was always their real home. They had a number of townhomes and apartments in New York that they enjoyed, but for them, home was always Ten Chimneys. And so eventually they lived here year-round together until Alfred passed away in 1977. But they loved Ben, and he did a wonderful job of taking care of this estate.
That's a wonderful story, Lois. And I think Lois kind of brings up an interesting angle to this, Sean, that I think it's hard to imagine today how huge stars of Hollywood and Broadway could actually come to a small town in Wisconsin and be left alone enough by the media to enjoy it. But
yeah. But
it was a really different era, I think, and the local people really felt kind of protective of them.
Oh, they really did. And I mean, people knew that the Lunts were there and that Helen Hayes was there and that Laurence Olivier was there, and people would try to come out. Not as much the media. There wasn't a hounding media like that in the era, but fans would come out. And so a lot of times people would drive into Genesee Depot and they'd be trying to find Ten Chimneys, and they would ask somebody for directions, and the person giving directions would intentionally get them lost again and sort of send them on their way so they wouldn't find the Lunts. And there was a famous story of one guy who was being really loud and sort of rude about wanting to find the Lunts and walked into the Stag, which was the local tavern, and went up to some guy and said, "I'm looking for the Lunt house. Where's Ten Chimneys? I need to go find it. My wife's in the car. Just tell me where it is." And the guy gave him, you know, directions on how to basically leave town and sent him back to Milwaukee. And you know, the other guy who was standing right next to the man who nicely sent people out of ways said, "Thanks a lot, Jim. Drinks are on me." And it was Alfred.
Wow.
Who was sitting there at the Stag. So the guy was in there looking for Alfred and went up right next to him directions to find him.
That's great. All right. Thanks for that call, Lois. And let's go to Phil in Golden Lake now. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Yeah, great show. Just wanted to give some accolades for the tour that you get when you go to visit Ten Chimneys. I've fortunately been there twice now, and brought there the first time by a friend and then brought a friend the second time. At any rate, I'm not into the lifestyles of the rich and famous. I don't do the mansion tours, the castle tours when I go on vacation, that sort of thing. But the thing I think that is so impressive about Ten Chimneys, and the docents are fantastic, I should say, is that they lived as what I would call pretty normal people as far as the actual lifestyle there. And although many of the antiques now are probably worth a lot of money, they were probably picked up for next to nothing by Alfred at some point. I read Margot Peter's biography subsequently, and apparently he was quite the skinflint, probably because of his mother's spendthrift ways. And I think, moreover, everything that's there was very personal. and you really have that feeling. And a lot of things were also very theatrical, like the much of the ornate decor was actually painted by a set designer, I believe, who lived with them for a year or two. So it isn't actually really ornate plasterwork. It just looks like it.
Right, right.
And it's really, really one of the best historic tours I've ever done, and I would recommend it very highly to anyone.
Thanks so much for that call, Phil.
And Phil.
And actually, Sean, I want to make sure people know how they can visit Ten Chimneys so we don't run out of time.
Oh, right.
Tours go through November 12th, is that right?
Yes, yes. And fall tours are beautiful here at Ten Chimneys. And you can check us out online, which is tenchimneys.org.
And there's a link to that from our Facebook page also.
Or just give us a call. All of the tours are guided tours. You don't just wander around on your own. And so they're scheduled, and though every once in a while we're able to accommodate a walk-in, it's much better to give us a call, even if it's the day before or the morning of, to make sure that we can try to squeeze you in.
And I think that our caller brought up a really good point, too, that the home is it's a fascinating blend, I think, of English and Swedish design sensibilities, representing both Alfred and Lynn, but also of stage and set design.
Yeah.
And you really do get a sense that you are at some points walking onto a stage or, you know, standing in front of an elaborate curtain or a backdrop.
I think you're right. And I think the other thing that really struck me about what Phil said that got me very excited is that it's not Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And we worked, that was a very intentional choice up front to not let Ten Chimneys be hero worship. That the point isn't look at the famous people who lived here. And honestly, the point, I mean, they are extraordinary collections, but the point isn't even look at these fantastic antiques. That there is an experience of visiting Ten Chimneys, and the themes and values that guided the Lunts' lives and that guided the experiences that the Lunts and Olivier and Coward and Hepburn and Hayes and everyone else had, they're still relevant. They're still meaningful. And so when people come through, you know, it's 90 minutes of stories, and they're stories that are meaningful, and they're stories in what I might argue is the perfect setting. But it's really about storytelling. It's really about this immersion experience that you get to have. And so, you know, 3/4 of the people who come to Ten Chimneys, and we ask these questions, we survey them, say that they had never heard of the Lunts before they heard of Ten Chimneys, the place to visit. And so you don't need to know who the Lunts are or know who any of these other theatrical names that we've been dropping are. It is a relevant place. It's a meaningful experience, and we work very hard at making sure that that's true because, like Phil, I don't go on the castle tours when I go on vacation. It's not enough for me to say, look how much money they spent on the marble floor. Leaves me a little cold. But you start talking about people's humanity and the way they lived, and these stories are things that can talk to me about how I might, what choices I might want to make.
Mm-hmm.
That starts to get, you know, that's real.
And
that's
as
powerful.
Phil said, too, the docents are really skilled at sharing those stories that really draw you in.
Yeah. And we do, you know, when all of our docents are volunteers, they're extraordinary, as are our other volunteers. And the docents go through a 14-week training program where they learn an extraordinary amount of knowledge and a huge basket of stories, and there is no script whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
We talk to them about the themes and values that we think matter to people and are connected to Ten Chimneys, and we talk about stories that illustrate those themes and ideas and values, and we talk about good places maybe to tell those stories. And then we let them create the tour they're going to create. And most docents will give a different tour every time they give a tour. And every docent gives a different tour than the next docent. And so when Phil came back the second time, he had a very different experience than he did the first time.
And I want to make sure people know where to call if they're interested in a tour. The number is 262-968-4110. Again, 262-968-4110. And you can also go to tenchimneys.org. 10 is spelled out for more information on tours. It sounds like Karen in Bayfield has a comment, too, so let's go to her. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Great program. It's Bayside, but
sorry about that.
No problem. Sean, I just wanted to tell you about a really fun experience that my husband had. In the late 60s, he was attending Carroll College, and at the time, the Lunts went and volunteered, I think, their time working with the theater students there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave the theater students the opportunity to come out and be part of the dinners that they had out there for, you know, all their different friends that were coming in. So my husband got to help, like, serve the dinners. Yeah. And he said it was just an amazing experience.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah. That would have been fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he brings it up all the time. I wish I would have been able to have an experience like that. But, yeah, I mean, it just speaks to who they were, that they would, you know, work with a local college like that and then invite the young people out to spend time with them and, you know, be part of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something that was important to them throughout their lives. They were really devoted to the next generation and to mentoring. And you certainly saw that on stage. And there were a number of young actors that they took under their wing. Laurence Olivier said, "Everything I know about acting I learned from Alfred Lunt." And other actors like Julie Harris and Montgomery Clift and Dick Van Patten, who the Lunts really groomed and mentored. But they also did that with people in the neighborhood, and particularly during the 30s. It's interesting that they kept on doing it through the 60s as well. But during the Depression, if you were a high school student and you had a work ethic, the Lunts would hire you, and then they would teach you the exact right way to lay a fire or weed a garden or serve tea. And we, about 10 years ago, did a whole lot of interviews, did some oral histories of people who had worked for the Lunts, who were teenagers in the 30s and were no longer teenagers and had these great stories. And with the only one exception, they talked about it being the most exciting time of their life, you know, unbelievable, and they got to do exactly what your husband had done. But one person was a cook, and she came in, and the interviewer said, so what was it like working for the Lunts, he asked. And she said, well, it was fine for a week. They said, oh, what happened after a week? She said, well, Mr. Lunt told me that Mr. Coward would be visiting, and that Mr. Coward would be going down for a swim every morning, and that he might come through my kitchen, and that when he did, he would probably not be wearing a bathing suit. And the cook said, and I told him, well, if he does, I'm out of here. And Noel did, and she was. And 65 years later, she was still pretty peeved about it. Had a decent amount of indignation about the fact that a naked Noel Coward had wandered through her kitchen on the way to the swimming pool. Noel didn't believe in swimsuits in the pool and saw no reason to put on something on his way to the pool if he wasn't going to wear anything there.
Noel Coward was really quite a flamboyant character, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Very much.
Thanks so much for that call, Karen. And I hope if you have not visited Ten Chimneys that you'll make your husband take you so he can show you what he did there.
Oh, no, I have, and it's great.
Oh, good.
Fantastic.
All right. And we have John in Green Bay next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Reason I'm calling, I'm writing a family history and just wanted to see if I went to Ten Chimneys, and I've been by the road going into it many times.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he did their taxes.
Hmm.
Is there a way to verify that if I were to show up there? And
who was that said he did their taxes?
My uncle.
Ah.
You know, what I would suggest is shoot us an email with his name. You should come by and see the place, but you wouldn't have a chance to dig through any drawers while you're on the tour. We're pretty protective of the artifacts, but that's a fascinating thing. And so if you wanted to email us, and our email addresses are on the website, then you could send the name and that sort of thing, and we would see if we had any documents or tax documents that might have his name on it.
Great. That sounds like a good option, John. And it's great that you're writing a family history and that the Lunts might figure in on it.
Is your uncle still alive?
Dead for almost 50 years.
Wow.
But he would talk about going to, you know, he lived just outside of Maquanigo.
Okay.
And would talk about the Lunts and, you know, and so forth. So I just, listening to the program here, just thought, well, I'll call and Just, I want to verify that.
Well, send us his name. We'll see what we can do for you.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, John. And Sean, there's so much to talk about, but there are a few things I wanted to make sure we touch on. One of the stories that really touched me when touring Ten Chimneys was Sir Laurence Olivier, as you mentioned, was a frequent guest and actually had his own bedroom there. And the docent told a wonderful story about how Larry came to comfort Lynn when Alfred passed away.
Yeah, he was doing Alfred died in 1977. Lynn lived for another 6 years after that, and Alfred was very ill for the last, particularly for the last several years of his life, and had multiple cancers and just was not doing well physically. And when Alfred actually passed away, Larry, Sir Larry at that point, was doing a show. I think it was Detroit. It might have been Boston, but I think it was Detroit. And he, Alfred died on a Friday. On Saturday, Olivier did an early matinee. There was an 11 o'clock matinee scheduled. After the matinee, he was driven to the airport. He flew to Milwaukee. He was driven out to Ten Chimneys, where he could sit with Lynn for just a little over an hour before he then had to get back into a car, head back to the airport, head back to Detroit to do an 8 o'clock performance that evening. And the people, as part of the play, said, "Sir Laurence, why don't you just wait until Sunday? We're finished with our week in just another day, and then you can stay for as long as you like." And he said, "Oh, I will, but Lynn needs me today. Mm-hmm. My friend needs me today." And he moved heaven and earth, even though he was just there for a one-week engagement. He couldn't miss a show, but he saw an opportunity for 90 minutes, an hour or 90 minutes sitting with Lynn. And took it.
And I think that really speaks to the depth of those friendships, that they weren't superficial, you know, what we think of as Hollywood kind mm-hmm. of, you know, air kissing kind of
right.
relationships. These were really deep, lifelong connections.
Right. You're absolutely right.
So historic sites and museums face many challenges to survive, including ongoing restoration and maintenance needs of older structures. What kind of projects had to be taken on to open Ten Chimneys as a historic site, and what are those ongoing needs?
And you're absolutely right. They're very significant. The capital campaign to save Ten Chimneys was a total of $12.5 million, the lion's share of which was for a comprehensive restoration of the estate and collections, or at least a thorough restoration. Comprehensive implies it's all done, and it never is. And so, I mean, it was about $12.5 million just to get the doors open. And that was particularly meaningful, and I'm particularly grateful to the community for making that happen, because until we raised that money and did that restoration, Ten Chimneys wasn't open to the public. Hmm. So this wasn't a place that had been open for 50 years and had, you know, a long history of tour guests and program guests and donors. And I mean, it was a blank page. And going out and saying to the community, this is what we need to raise. And that steps back to the man who founded this organization, who's from Madison, just an extraordinary man named Joe Garten, who has since passed away, who saw the potential of what a restored Ten Chimneys could be, what it could mean to visitors, what it could mean to American theater. And he put his heart and soul into inspiring people to support this place, to give money to restore the estate, but also to give their counsel and advice to say, what could it be? What should it be? How do we affect people's lives with Ten Chimneys? And I continue to be grateful for both his work and leadership and for his friendship every day. And that was the big part of getting it done originally. We've certainly spent a lot of money since then. It's a historic estate. And so we've spent about $7 million in the last 9 years on combined annual preservation and new restoration projects that are certainly too numerous to go into mm-hmm. on the phone. And we'll have a lot more to do next year, you know, another somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million worth of restoration mm-hmm. work that we'll need to do next year. And that is always funded by the community,
mm-hmm.
Mostly Wisconsin, but not entirely Wisconsin. It's people who say, this matters, what you're doing matters, and I'm going to help out a little bit.
And let's make sure in just the last few seconds we have here that people know where to call or where to go online to find out about tours.
Sure. Well, our phone number is 262-968-4110, and they can set you up with a tour and let you know what else is coming up. Or you can always learn more at 10chimneys.org.
Sean Malone, president of 10 Chimneys Foundation, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And I hope you will stay tuned for other great programming on the Ideas Network. And tune in at 11 tomorrow. We will be talking about gardens, and we'll be talking specifically about why mulching and composting are important and how to do it correctly. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller.
China Mieville's new novel, Embassy Town, features sentient beings famous for their unique language and a woman who's a living simile. Ursula K. Le Guin says that Embassy Town is a fully achieved work of art. And Jim Fleming, Sunday afternoon on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll discuss the language of science fiction. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Sunday at noon on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Chad's Carpentry, dedicated to educating customers about environmentally friendly building practices and the benefits of building tight and ventilating right. Learn more at Chad's